today's episode of the HealthTree Podcast for Multiple Myeloma, a show that connects patients with myeloma researchers. I'm your host, Jenny Alstrom. Before we get started today on the show, I'd like to make a short announcement that we're beginning our 10-year anniversary celebration. So we started HealthTree for Multiple Myeloma, and you might know it formerly as Myeloma Crowd, in late 2012, and I really never could have imagined that it would become what it is today. We have so many programs to support you, like our patient navigator team, our coach program, HealthTree University, our news website, this podcast, our live roundtable meetings, our HealthTree Moves app, HealthTree Cure Hub, and our incredible webinar events and chapters, which will reach, in total over a million users cumulatively to those programs this year alone. We now have a staff of over 60 people that are incredibly happy to support you. So if you have benefited from these programs, we invite your support or the sharing of our new fundraising campaign with your family and friends, and our goal is to raise $500,000 before year end. You can donate by clicking on the top right donate button on the website, which is at healthtree.org/myeloma, and know that 100% of your donation will be used to further myeloma research that we are doing jointly with myeloma researchers. So thank you in advance and for your consideration. Now on to our show. Having a new multiple myeloma treatment is very exciting, and recently teclistamab was approved by the FDA for myeloma. This is the first bispecific antibody, and we are so pleased to have Dr. Alfred Garfall with us today to share more about this new therapy. So Dr. Garfall, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's so nice to be here.
Well, we so appreciate you taking your time out. I know you're getting probably hounded by people asking you about this approval since you were leading this clinical trial, but I just want to give a short introduction for you before we get started. So Dr. Garfall is director of the autologous bone marrow transplant department at the University of Pennsylvania and assistant professor of medicine. At UPenn, he's a member of the Clinical Trial Scientific Review and Monitoring Committee, member of the University of Pennsylvania Institutional Review Board, and he performs teaching and mentorship of UPenn fellows in hematology and oncology. He has performed publication review for many major blood cancer publications, including Nature Medicine, Lancet Hematology, Blood Advances, Leukemia, Clinical Cancer Research, and the ASCO Self-Evaluation Program Myeloma Chapter. Dr. Garfall graduated with honors from Princeton University and has won awards including the Career Development Award from the Concord Cancer Society of ASCO and the Scholar and Clinical Research Award from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, in addition to many others. With UPenn really, in my opinion, leading the way on CAR-T therapy and immunotherapies globally, Dr. Garfall has been deeply involved in CAR-T and other immunotherapies as early as 2014, and he was the primary investigator on the teclistamab trial, so we are very fortunate to have him with us today. So Dr. Garfall, maybe we want to just start by giving a broad overview. Since this is new in a drug class, can you explain what a bispecific antibody is in myeloma and how it works?
Sure, of course. So bispecific antibodies are a class of cancer therapies where the antibody has two targets. And so we're used to thinking of monoclonal antibodies for cancer like daratumumab, where the antibody recognizes one target, and that target is a molecule on the surface of multiple myeloma cells. So in the case of daratumumab, that molecule is CD38. And when you give that antibody as a drug, that antibody will bind to CD38 on the myeloma cells, and then that antibody will flag those myeloma cells for certain parts of the immune system that can come in and attack the myeloma cells, just the way an antibody against a virus or a bacteria would work. And so that's how conventional antibodies work. And the parts of the immune system that conventional antibodies activate are parts of what we call the innate immune system, like natural killer cells and macrophages. And those cells are able to kill multiple myeloma cells in response to antibodies like daratumumab. What we've learned over in recent years, however, is that another part of the immune system called the adaptive immune system, and specifically T cells in the immune system, they are able to kill cancer cells a little bit more potently than the innate immune system. And so what bispecific antibodies are a way to get, in the form of an antibody, to get the immune system, the T cells in the immune system, to recognize the cancer rather than just the innate immune system like regular antibodies do. So the way bispecific antibodies are formatted is that they have two targets. And so one target is on the multiple myeloma cell, just like a conventional antibody. But the other target is a target on a T cell. And so you can think of these antibodies as having two arms. One arm grabs the myeloma cell, and one arm grabs the T cell, the cell in your immune system called the T cell, and forces the T cell to come over to the multiple myeloma cell, get activated, and kill the multiple myeloma cell. So the bispecific antibody serves as a bridge between the T cells and the multiple myeloma cells to get the T cells to kill the multiple myeloma cells. And that engagement of the immune system seems to be a bit more potent than the type of engagement you can get with a regular monoclonal antibody like daratumumab. And so what we've seen in clinical trials now with several different bispecific antibodies in multiple myeloma is that in patients with what we say relapse disease, people with more advanced myeloma, the kind of patients that enroll on phase one clinical trials, you see, you know, most of the patients on these trials responding to these bispecific antibodies, where we wouldn't expect such, or we didn't see such high response rates when traditional monoclonal antibodies were tested in multiple myeloma. In fact, what we see with bispecific antibodies is the same kind of T cell activation against the myeloma that previously you could only get with CAR T cells. And CAR T cells may turn out in the end to be a little bit more potent than bispecific antibodies, but bispecific antibodies are probably pretty close. And what's amazing is that you can get that activation of T cells against the myeloma in the form of a drug that you can just give as a subcutaneous injection rather than the more complex procedure that you have to go through to get CAR T cell therapy, which requires collecting T cells from you, waiting, you know, sending those T cells off to a company to go through a manufacturing process, and then waiting for them during that time, and then getting the T cells back and infused to you. It's a little bit more of a still a very effective therapy, but a little bit more of a complicated process. The idea that we can get that same kind of T cell activation against the cancer in the form of a drug that we can just give as a subcutaneous injection is really a big step forward.
Yeah, well, it's a huge opportunity for a lot of patients who either can't qualify for CAR-T or it's not available for CAR-T, so this is a great additional option for patients. And I think it's pretty exciting that it's out and now approved. Can you talk a little bit about BCMA as a target, just generally speaking, because we know it's a target for an antibody-drug conjugate, Blenrep, and we know it's a target for CAR-T, and now it's a target for bispecific antibodies. So can you explain just a little bit about the target and why this target is important or why it was chosen?
Sure. So as I mentioned at the outset, all antibodies that target multiple myeloma have to recognize the multiple myeloma by some kind of protein that's on the surface of the multiple myeloma cell. That's how the antibody can recognize myeloma and not recognize other cells in the body. So I mentioned that daratumumab, an antibody that's been around for a little while for multiple myeloma, recognizes CD38. But there's a whole new wave of immunotherapies that are coming out, including the CAR T cells that are already FDA approved, teclistamab, and then a whole, you know, belantamab, which is an antibody drug conjugate, and then many more coming down the pike, other bispecific antibodies that are similar to teclistamab. They work by recognizing the myeloma by BCMA. So BCMA, also, which is an acronym for B-cell maturation antigen, this is a protein that's on the surface of multiple myeloma cells. And what's nice about it as an immunotherapy target is that it seems to be very nicely restricted to myeloma cells and normal plasma cells. There may be some bit of expression in other cells of the body, but there's not a lot of it. And so that makes it a safe immunotherapy target, because we know if we develop a therapy that targets BCMA, mm-hmm. it's mainly going to target multiple myeloma cells and their normal counterparts. So it also is going to target normal plasma cells. And that is where some of the risk of these BCMA therapy-directed therapies comes into play, is that we also expect them to kill normal plasma cells in the immune system, and normal plasma cells in the immune system are the cells that are responsible for making antibodies that help fight infections, and patients that get immunotherapies that target BCMA often have low antibody levels and as a result increased risk of infection, and that certainly was seen with teclistamab. But BCMA is a marker that's on the surface of multiple myeloma cells. It has functions in how plasma cells work basically in the immune system. It connects with certain other components of the bone marrow to help plasma cells kind of stay healthy in the bone marrow. That's its role in normal biology. It also probably helps multiple myeloma cells grow a little bit more, and that's another reason why it's a good idea to target BCMA. So there's lots of different therapies that are being developed against BCMA. We already know about CAR T cells that are FDA approved, the antibody drug conjugate belantamab. Now we have teclistamab, and there are more CAR T cells and bispecific antibodies coming down the pike that target BCMA.
Right, and it seems to be in this bispecific field, targeting BCMA, well, other targets too, right? But it seems to be kind of a pretty crowded field. And when you look at, like, proteasome inhibitors, you have, like, a Velcade or a carfilzomib, and those work really quite differently, but they still are both proteasome inhibitors. Do you see that same thing in the bispecific antibodies, or are they more similar? I'm just kind of curious about that.
Yeah, it's really early to tell because, I think there are at least half a dozen of these bispecific antibodies targeting BCMA that are in various stages of clinical trials. We know just little bits of information here and there about them. From what I can tell, their clinical activity seems similar, but they haven't been directly compared to one another. It'll be a long while before we get any real sense of whether one is more potent than the other. But I think they all are similar in terms of their, if you look at the response rates in the clinical trials that have been reported, similar response rates, similar side effect and toxicity profiles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see how that all falls out because it seems like it's like a race on the bispecific antibodies.
Yeah.
And teclistamab was the first to approval. So let's talk about the approval a little bit. How was it approved? Like for what type of patient?
Sure. So it was approved, and you were very generous about our contribution to the clinical trial, but I'll just emphasize that this was a big global clinical trial that led to the approval of teclistamab, and we were significant contributors in terms of the number of our patients who enrolled in the trial, but there are also other major sites in the U.S. and around the world that contributed, and of course this study was led by Janssen Pharmaceuticals, the company that makes the drug, and obviously they had an enormous role in developing the medicine. So, it was approved based on, phase one and two trials. So the first phase of any, new drug being developed is just to find the right dose and assess whether it's safe. And so there were a couple years of treating patients with teclistamab, with initially very low doses until the trial finally got up to a dose that seemed to give reliable responses and have an acceptable safety profile. And then the phase two portion of the study entailed treating a larger number of patients with that dose that had been determined to be safe and effective, and seeing how those patients did. And those patients were mainly patients who had all the major drugs for multiple myeloma. If you think about the major medications being, immunomodulatory drugs like lenalidomide and pomalidomide, proteasome inhibitors like bortezomib and carfilzomib, when the FDA looked at the data from the clinical trials to decide where they would officially approve, and what patients they would officially approve the medicine, they approved it in patients who have had four or more prior lines of multiple myeloma therapy, which is a rough way of saying four or more different regimens or combinations of therapies in the past, and still had disease that was progressing after that. That was roughly the patient population that was in the clinical trial.
Mm-hmm. And when they got approval, it's the same, right? So, it's four or more prior lines of therapy.
Yeah, that's what the approval says. And that is a similar language to the approvals for belantamab, which is the antibody drug conjugate that targets BCMA, and also the two CAR T cells that are FDA approved, and I think selinexor also. So now we have this, several medications or therapies that are approved for that cohort of patients.
Mm-hmm. Okay, wonderful. And just so patients know about prior lines of therapy, like you can say you got like Revlimid, Velcade, Dex, like RVD, and then you go to a transplant and you get maintenance therapy, and that's considered one prior line of therapy. It's not that just one time you used Dara and one time you used a proteasome inhibitor. And So I think sometimes patients don't know that. And so you'll need to talk to your doctor about if you've had four or more prior lines of therapy and if that's considered prior lines. So just that's something for patients to think about.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, that it's getting a little more complicated, too, because, you know, now it's often the case that patients are treated with, you know, we've learned over time that combining therapies early on is sometimes very helpful. And so you see, it used to be that, you know, you would get Revlimid and dexamethasone first, but now we do Revlimid, Velcade, dexamethasone, and even now we're sometimes adding daratumumab into the mix. And so you can have a patient who's only had one line of multiple myeloma therapy, but they've actually been exposed to three or four major drugs, you know. And so we shouldn't think strictly about lines of therapy when we think about treatment options, and this aspect of treatment planning has to be discussed in a personalized way. Sometimes we are successful, you know, the FDA approval doesn't restrict physicians' ability to prescribe medications, but it sometimes is what insurance companies use for guidance about what's a justified use of the medication that they would reimburse. And we're sometimes successful in requesting approval from an insurance company to give a medicine for a patient that is slightly outside what the FDA put in the label. And a good example of that in multiple myeloma would be maybe somebody who's had only two or three lines of therapy, but in those two or three lines of therapy, the patient has received every major multiple myeloma medication. It's just that those medications have been combined into two or three lines of therapy. We have sometimes been successful in obtaining coverage from insurance companies, and I think that's a medically justified thing to do for some of these more advanced therapies. If patients really have moved through all the major multiple myeloma therapy, they've just done it in two or three lines of therapy rather than four.
Yeah, that's a really important point, that you can go talk to your doctor about that.
Exactly.
And not kind of make an assumption. And I think some of these approvals, it seems like they're all approved in later lines of therapy, and then the companies are still working hard to do clinical trials that are using them in earlier lines of therapy, but they always have to start in the later for safety and those types of reasons to compare it to, is this better than what we already have in our arsenal, you know, to before they move it up, right?
That's right, and it's important to note that a lot of these therapies have received what the FDA terms accelerated approval, meaning that the results looked quite good in studies where patients with advanced disease got the medication and had a response and seemed to tolerate the medication well and had a good safety profile. But those clinical trials that lead to these accelerated approvals, and teclistamab's in this category, those are not comparative trials. And so these were not trials where teclistamab was being compared against something else and proven to be better than the alternative. And ultimately what is required for full approval is a comparative study where teclistamab is compared to something else, some other standard of care, and found to be better than something that has already been proven to be safe and effective. And that's really important, so because, you know, we've had some instances in cancer medicines and in multiple myeloma therapies where medications that were given this accelerated approval upon further study turned out to not be as effective as they were initially thought based on the accelerated approval. And so those other studies that you mentioned that companies are undertaking, those are often testing the new medication in an earlier line of therapy, but they're also comparing the medication to another established therapy to prove that it's at least as safe or arguably safer and at least as effective or perhaps more effective than some alternative. And that's ultimately the kind of evidence we need to be really sure that the medication that we're using is safe and effective. But these accelerated approvals are still very important because a lot of them are later confirmed, and by allowing the accelerated approval, it allows patients who really need something now to get access to the medication based on the preliminary information from these early phase 1 and 2 studies before the full phase 3 studies are complete, and that availability can be life-saving for some patients.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, all great points. So let's talk about teclistamab's administration. How is this drug administered? And how frequently?
Yeah, so it's given as a subcutaneous injection, which is, I just have to say, really amazing. Just as I mentioned, the contrast between the complexity of, you know, to get that kind of effectiveness and activation of T cells against the multiple myeloma in the form of a simple subcutaneous injection is really amazing. So it's given as a subcutaneous injection. With teclistamab and other therapies that activate T cells against myeloma, you run the risk of some of these inflammatory side effects with the initial dosing. And so if your listeners are familiar with CAR T cells, of course, we worry about cytokine release syndrome, which is the syndrome of fevers that can potentially progress to more concerning features like low blood pressure, difficulty breathing. It's even occasionally fatal. But usually mild and manageable, but occasionally fatal. Those are reactions that tend to happen early on with therapies that activate T cells. So it's something that happens early on after CAR T cell infusion. And with bispecific antibodies, you get the same risk of cytokine release syndrome. There's also a neurologic toxicity that also goes along with these intense activations of the immune system that we have to watch for. Again, usually doesn't happen. If it does happen, it's usually mild and manageable, but occasionally it's severe and even potentially fatal. So in order to, you know, to reduce the risk of overactivating the immune system early on, most bispecific antibodies that are being tested for multiple myeloma are given in what we call step-up doses or priming doses, where before you get to the full dose of the medication, you're given a couple smaller doses. And so the way the FDA has instructed us to administer teclistamab is to give, and I'm going to use these units of milligrams per kilogram, but it's to start with a dose called 0.06 and then give a dose called 0.3 and then a dose of 1.5 milligrams per kilogram. And so we give those doses a couple days apart, and it's suggested that patients be in the hospital for that time. So you would come in the hospital, get that first tiny, you know, that first small dose as a subcutaneous injection, wait at least 2 days to see if there's any cytokine release syndrome or neurologic toxicity that develops. If that develops, we kind of let it run its course and treat it. And then when that has settled down, you can give the next dose, wait 48 hours, see if any of the side effects develop. And then once they've passed, or at least 48 hours later, give the third dose, which is the full dose of 1.5 milligrams per kilogram. And so in the best case scenario, that plays out over 6 days in the hospital, where you get a dose on one day, get a dose 2 days later, get a dose 2 days after that, and then be observed for 2 days after the last dose, and then you can be discharged. And then after that, you would return to the outpatient clinic and receive the subcutaneous injection weekly. And the way the FDA approved it is for as weekly subcutaneous injections, as long as it continues to work indefinitely. I suspect that,
okay.
And this is,
yeah.
Go ahead, sorry. No, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I suspect with time we will space out these doses once patients respond, and that's definitely taken place in the clinical trial where patients who are in good responses have been able to reduce the frequency of dosing to every 2 weeks or even every 4 weeks and maintain good responses that way. But right, the way it's officially dosed in the prescribing information is once weekly indefinitely.
Yeah, so interesting. Well, I like the step-up dosing idea. I mean, it does make things a little bit more complex about how it's given and you know, you're in the hospital a couple days over time. But I think that's smart because I've had a friend who did a different bispecific antibody through a trial, had a very, you know, very big response, but then didn't have any other CRS or neurological kind of response after that. So it seems like it's not, like you were saying before, it's not as high as a CAR T, for example, but it can happen. So it's smart that they're doing the step-up dosing.
Yeah, and those side effects tend to be confined to those early doses. And so, it's possible after you leave the hospital you might get a little cytokine release syndrome within the first month or so, but for the most part after that, you don't have any of those severe or concerning side effects. And so it's a little bit of an investment, you know, in the first week just to kind of get the medication started safely. But fortunately, once you get past those first few doses, the risk of that happening is very low, and it's very safe to give the medication as an outpatient.
Mm-hmm. Great. And then I have a question. Are you seeing, as you're dosing or doing the step-up dosing, does the cytokine release or CRS or the neurological toxicities, does that have anything to do with tumor burden that you're seeing the patients come in at, like, oh, I have a very high tumor burden, and I have more of that, and I have, because that's kind of what they're seeing a little bit in CAR-T, right? Is it the same?
Yeah, so it's there. Well, you know, I would say that most of the patients on the clinical trial, because they had relapsed refractory multiple myeloma, had a fair amount of tumor burden. There's obviously a range there, but these are all patients with really active multiple myeloma. You know, I can't say off the top of my head if they've done an analysis about the risk or intensity of cytokine release syndrome according to, say, how many plasma cells were present in the bone marrow. In the teclistamab study, about 70% of patients had cytokine release syndrome, and it was almost all low grade, meaning that they didn't develop any of the more severe complications of cytokine release syndrome. But about half the people who developed CRS had significant enough abnormalities, even if they didn't reach the official criteria for high grade, they were significant enough abnormalities that warranted us giving that antidote to cytokine release syndrome, that tocilizumab antibody that can calm down some of the inflammation. So basically 70% of people get CRS, about half of them required the intervention of that antibody. But I don't know exactly how that breaks down in terms of tumor burden or risk factors for that. And I would say that we, just in my experience taking care of patients with the medication, you know, it is, even if there are some rough correlates, it's not, I would say, reliably predictable. We had some patients who had a high tumor burden and didn't develop a lot of CRS, other patients with low tumor burden who did. What's also interesting is that the dose association is really interesting. So we have some patients who, after that first or second really small dose, have significant cytokine release syndrome. And if you really check their multiple myeloma markers really early, like after that second dose, before the third dose, you'll see that they've responded to those tiny doses. Oh. Other patients, they don't develop CRS until they get the full dose, and they don't respond until they get the full dose. And we've even had some patients who were delayed in their response even a month or so, kind of while the drug built up in their body. So there really is at least so far, I haven't seen anybody come up with an explanation for this, but a real difference between patients in terms of what dose is able to activate the immune system and generate both the myeloma response and some of the side effects that go with it.
Yeah, that early versus late response will be interesting to see, like, prolonged responses. Does that have any impact at all on how mm-hmm. long you respond? That's super interesting. Okay. You talked about that patients will receive it until they progress. I know there's a lot of talk about looking at MRD situations, like, okay, if I'm MRD negative for 2 years, do I stop? If I continue to be MRD positive, I probably want to stay on treatment. But do you have any thoughts around how long a patient might end up being on it? I guess it's too early to say, maybe, but
it really is too early to say. You know, I would say that patients who respond tend to have very good responses, and, you know, often complete responses, and those responses are very durable. You know, I think the estimated something like 70% of patients who responded at 12 months were still in a response, which is really impressive considering that these patients were patients who had been refractory to a lot of other prior myeloma therapies. And so is it possible that you could stop the medication and that the response would persist for a long time? It's very possible for those patients who are in deep responses, but I don't know that I know we don't know all the, I don't think we know yet how to make those decisions. You know, there are some other bispecific antibodies that are being, so teclistamab was tested as an indefinite therapy, and so you keep getting it as long as you're progressing, or sorry, as long as you're responding, unless you have side effects that weren't stopping, and we've definitely had patients who have had infections and COVID-19 and that had to stop it for a while, and those patients tended to remain in remission while they were off it, but once they recovered from whatever side effect or infection, they resumed teclistamab. I believe we're going to see at ASH this year some data with cevostamab, which is another bispecific antibody, where the way that is given on the clinical trials is that you receive it for, if you're responding, you receive it for a while. I think it's like 18 months or so. But then if you're in a response, you stop it. And then you wait. And then if the disease starts to grow at some point in the future, you can resume the medication. And so we may, I believe in the ASH report this year that we should get, you know, next month, they talk a little bit about how those patients did who stopped it and how long they stayed in remission after stopping it if they were in a good response, and how they responded if they progressed. You know, some of those things that we need to know if we need to continue it forever or can stop it, that's going to take some time to figure out.
Yeah, well, definitely. So this was approved as a single agent drug, right? So by itself and not in combination. And we know that myeloma, most myeloma therapies are given in combination. So that's not really, is it possible to give it in combination with something else, or the doctor just wouldn't do that? They would just try it by itself because that's how it's approved.
Yeah, for now, as it's approved, it's approved as a monotherapy, and you know, meaning that, you know, you're not giving it in combination with anything else. There are studies going on testing combinations to see if that helps, but you always have to I personally wouldn't do that right this minute with this medication outside of a clinical trial, because with any new combination comes some risk, and if you're not sure that it works better as a combination, it can be a little bit risky to try it as a combination. You might get some side effects without any benefit. Inevitably with new drugs, as you said, you know, they get tested in combinations, and I think we'll pretty quickly learn, you know, which combinations make sense and which combinations are safe and effective versus which ones, you know, maybe there's not a lot of good interaction between the combined. And, you know, as the number of myeloma therapies increases, it becomes, you know, a little bit more sprawling, all the different potential combinations, and it's going to take some time to figure out which ones are good combinations. Yeah,
I've heard people say, like, oh, we don't want to use Dex with any immunotherapies because that may be damaging, or, like, so we just don't know at this point what it can and can't be combined with.
Correct. Now, I will say that with the initial doses of teclistamab, there is some dexamethasone that's given to kind of reduce the risk.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, just with the first couple doses, with those initial step-up doses, there's some dexamethasone pre-medication given. And that's how it was done in the clinical trials, with the idea of reducing the risk of allergic reactions and reducing the risk of, you know, severe abrupt cytokine release syndrome. It's possible that those dexamethasone doses aren't necessary, but for now they're included in the prescribing information. But it's really a small amount of dex in the big scheme of things, and the ongoing dosing, which patients who respond, you know, will likely be on it for months or even years. There's no ongoing weekly dexamethasone like there is with so many other multiple myeloma therapies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wonderful. And it is basically its own maintenance therapy because you're staying on it. So when we talked about side effects, you kind of outlined three major areas. Cytokine release syndrome, which is, like you mentioned, was like the fever and the chills and that type of thing. Then the neurotoxicity potentially. Sometimes if patients hear that the term ICANS, that's probably in that same group, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, yep. I can never remember what that stands for, but maybe you do.
Immune effector cell associated neurotoxicity syndrome. But it's basically a set of neurologic side effects that can happen with these immunotherapies that activate T cells. And it was first reported with CAR T cells, but also with bispecific antibodies. And it can cause anything from, you know, very mild confusion that's very short-lived to more severe complications like swelling of the brain that can be potentially fatal. As I said, fortunately, with bispecific antibodies, the risk is a bit lower. And with teclistamab, they found very little ICANS, and it tended to be low grade. There are a couple other neurologic toxicities that have been reported, including with teclistamab, with different BCMA-directed therapies, both the CAR T cells and the bispecific antibodies. And so there was this wasn't from the clinical trial data, but it came out in the training that the FDA sent out to physicians about teclistamab, that there was one case of something called Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is an autoimmune type neuropathy that causes weakness, and in this case it was fatal. That was just one reported case. But something like that has been seen with some other BCMA-directed immunotherapies, either bispecific antibodies or CAR T-cells. And so it's kind of believable that reaction was related to the drug, and so we are really careful to watch for these different neurologic toxicities, ICANS, and then some of these other weirder ones that have been seen just with BCMA-directed therapy so far.
Mm-hmm. And then you said that the CRS and the ICANS kind of resolve earlier and that infections might be just kind of later just because it's ongoing and
mm-hmm.
your immune system's kind of involved in that. So is there anything else that patients should be aware of or as they select this as their therapy? Uh-huh.
Yeah. So the infection thing warrants a bit more discussion because we're used to thinking of infections as a risk factor of all multiple myeloma therapies. But I think the risk of infection with the teclistamab is a bit higher than the risk with other multiple myeloma therapies like daratumumab and carfilzomib. There were a fair number of patients who got infections with the teclistamab, including serious infections. This trial took place amidst the COVID-19 pandemic, and sadly, several patients on the clinical trial died of COVID-19. And then we also have seen some opportunistic infections. And so infections like pneumocystis pneumonia, opportunistic infections are infections that tend to occur in especially immunocompromised patients. So a type of pneumonia called pneumocystis pneumonia, there was one case of a brain infection called progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy, which is a viral infection of the brain that is often fatal, and it was fatal in this case. And so with kind of prolonged exposure to teclistamab, there is a significant risk of infection. So there are some things that patients should do to reduce the risk of infection. And so with COVID-19, we really want all our patients to get vaccinated against COVID-19. With our patients getting teclistamab, we've been very diligent about giving them Evusheld because patients with teclistamab really cannot make their own antibodies because of the effect of the drug on normal plasma cells. So Evusheld is a way to kind of get a dose of COVID antibodies in case the vaccine doesn't induce your body to make its own antibodies. And so we've been giving patients Evusheld. In patients who get COVID-19, we've been very proactive about prescribing Paxlovid, the antiviral medication that reduces the risk of progression to severe COVID-19. So we've been really encouraging patients to be diligent about COVID-19 prevention. We've been giving patients a prophylactic antibiotic that reduces the risk of that particular pneumonia type, pneumocystis pneumonia. We've been giving patients acyclovir or a similar medication to reduce the risk of shingles or herpes virus reactivation. And then most of our patients are also receiving intravenous immune globulin, which is like an antibody replacement therapy, basically giving you, kind of like we can give red cell transfusions when you're low on red cells, we can give antibody transfusions when you're low on antibodies. And because this medication reduces your body's ability to make antibodies in such a profound way, we've been pretty proactive about giving patients intravenous immune globulin to replete their antibody levels, especially if they're going to be on the medication for a long time. So those are some of the ways we've tried to prevent infection, but still some of our patients have gotten infections and even severe infections. The other side effect to be aware of is some low blood counts, and so most of the patients developed some form of low blood counts, especially early on. Some patients have required transfusions, especially in the first couple months, and specifically low neutrophil counts seem to be a problem. It's a very manageable problem. And it can be a little bit random. So patients can have a fine neutrophil count early on, and then suddenly they're getting the medication for a while, and they develop some low neutrophil counts. You might have to hold a dose here and there. Sometimes patients have required, filgrastim or Zarzio or Neupogen to kind of boost the white blood cell count. And fortunately, the neutrophil count responds very promptly to, filgrastim or Zarzio or Neupogen, whichever name you want to use for it, when it's needed. But that's something that we've seen commonly and can occur early, can occur later on, but it's very manageable.
And I have a question, too. So and it sounds very similar to a lot of the CAR-T kind of side effects. And this, in some instances, I guess very rarely, but they might take some bank stem cells that you have, like for a transplant, that have been reserved mm-hmm. for a transplant, and kind of use them. Do you ever do that with the bispecifics?
So I've not heard of that being required for bispecific antibodies.
Oh, no, not required, but just like doing it if patients have really low counts.
Got it. Yeah, and so no, I've not heard of that being used for bispecific antibodies that approach. In the case of CAR T cells, yeah. So we've had a couple of patients who have had that complication of CAR T cell therapy, and I would say that's a more severe problem than what we've seen with teclistamab. And so with teclistamab and other bispecific antibodies, it's been, I would say, not quite as severe or long lived as we've seen with very few CAR T cell patients who have had that problem where just all their counts are all their white blood cell count, red blood cell count, platelets, all very low for a long time. You do a bone marrow biopsy and it looks like the bone marrow is really suppressed. And so that is a relatively uncommon complication of CAR T cell therapy where we've to get around that, we've given patients a dose of stem cells. And for a lot of myeloma patients, we have stem cells stored from their prior stem cell transplants, and we can do that, and it has been effective. I have not heard of any cases of such severe suppression of blood counts with teclistamab. And that's probably because, you know, unlike with CAR T cells, with teclistamab, if you get really severe side effects, you can just pause the medication and give things some time to recover. Whereas CAR T cells, they're, you know, and this is both good and bad, you know, they can maybe generate more intense activity in the body, and it's a little bit less easy to control because you kind of put the CAR T cells in and they're going to do what they're going to do, and it's a little bit different from patient to patient. With bispecific antibodies, because they're continuously dosed, you can always just pause the bispecific antibody if you develop a significant low blood count, and that's what was done on the clinical trials. You know, there were kind of rules in place to if you saw a low blood count of a certain severity, you pause the medication, wait a week or two for it to recover, maybe give some Neupogen, et cetera, and then resume it once the blood count got a little bit better. And all of those guidelines are in the prescribing information that physicians can use to kind of give us, that gives instructions basically on how to manage some of these side effects.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Okay, now can we talk about just practicality of obtaining this therapy? So if I go to my doctor and they say, yes, you qualify to receive this therapy, this is a good option for me. When you talk about the hospitalization for those first few doses, like if you're going to a local provider versus an academic center that might have a little more experience with that, like can the local provider do all of that, or do you need to go to like a myeloma academic center for a couple days and then get your subsequent shots, you know, through your local provider? How are you managing that? How does that work?
Yeah, so I mean, this is what we'll have to figure out as we get started with it. You know, we still haven't we haven't given it to anybody yet outside the clinical trial. So you know, there's always this delay between when a medication is approved and when we can actually start using it, because it has to be kind of go through some institutional processes, and the suppliers have to figure out how to ship the medication and all those things. But with this medication, the FDA has instituted what's called a REMS program, which is a requirement that places that are going to administer the medication have gone through some very basic training about how to manage some of these side effects and some of the particulars about the dosing that I just mentioned, you know, how to give the different step-up doses, how to manage the CRS and neurotoxicity. It's a very simple process, but still it requires a little bit of institutional initiative to get, you know, everybody who's going to be taking care of the patient certified in this program. And so we as a center that takes care of lots of multiple myeloma patients, you know, our pharmacists and hospital, we're all kind of ready to go with it and are going through that process now. But a site that doesn't take care of as many multiple myeloma patients, or maybe an oncology practice that is not as closely tied to a hospital as a big academic center, which is all under one umbrella, that might take a little time for those places to kind of learn about the medication and go through the process of getting started with it. And then in addition, you really need to think about some of the expertise necessary to manage the cytokine release syndrome and how a particular place is set up to do those inpatient doses, depending on how closely tied the oncology practice is to a community hospital, say. I really do think it's within the capability of you know, any hospital and oncology practice partnership to administer this medication, but it will probably take a little bit of time until places are kind of comfortable with it across these different care settings between like big academic centers and community centers. Where I imagine in our own practice network that the way this will get started is that patients will probably come down to our center to get started on the medication and get through those for the first month or two. And then patients will then want to return to you know, a practice closer to home to continue the medication. And that's a much simpler thing to do because, like I said, the risk of those toxicities are most significant in the early dosing. And so that process of kind of transitioning a patient who is already stable on the medication and responding back to a local practice might give some of those local practices some initial familiarity with the medication before they want to bite off the early dosing. And then maybe as a next step, they'll try and start the medication on some patients once they have everything kind of set up with their hospitals to be able to give it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure that process will get worked out because I know patients are excited about receiving this therapy. I know this therapy had really good overall response rates, and it's an off-the-shelf product. So in terms of getting like a very strong BCMA-directed therapy and effective therapy, it's really good. I just wanted to ask if the myeloma genetics mattered, because I know, you know, in the past we were all talking about precision medicine and maybe targeting all these genetic therapies, but CAR-T and bispecific antibodies don't really do that, and they seem to be working well for all patients across the board. Do you have any just comments about genetic features in terms of the bispecific antibodies?
Yeah, so it does seem like the targets that are, you know, the targets of the bispecific antibodies like BCMA, and then there's a couple other ones coming down the pike that target other molecules on the surface of myeloma cells, they seem to be pretty widely expressed across all multiple myelomas. Not a guarantee in any given case, but it's not as though we know that there's a certain genetic marker that means your myeloma is not going to express this target. What we have learned, and this has really been just reported in a couple cases of patients who have received CAR T cells, that after exposure to one of these therapies that targets, say, BCMA, it's possible for the multiple myeloma that eventually progresses on this therapy to have lost expression of BCMA. So that patient will then have a BCMA-negative multiple myeloma and will probably not respond to another therapy that targets BCMA, at least at that time. Now, who knows how that could change over time? Could the BCMA come back? There's all this complicated genetics underlying these shifts in BCMA expression or loss of BCMA, and that's just going to have to be figured out over time. And so that's not the typical way we think about genetics in multiple myeloma, where we're talking about different cytogenetic translocations and deletion 17p and plus 1q, all those different genetic subtypes of multiple myeloma. But it is speaking to kind of profiling individual patients' multiple myelomas to see if they still express the target of the drug. And it's going to take a while for us to figure that out. It's not, you know, perfectly straightforward how to test multiple myelomas for expression of these different targets. Perhaps there's just a tiny amount of the target there that your test can't detect, but that's enough to that the drug can recognize it. And so we have to be careful about how we use some of those tests, and it's going to take a little while to figure that out.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that whole sequencing question that you're talking about is an important one for patients. Like, can I, you know, do I need to jump to a different, because there are bispecific antibodies targeting different, like GPR, C5D.
Exactly.
And the other one that starts with an F that I can never remember.
FCRH5.
Yeah. But so you could go to a different target, like, and what you're saying is you might be able to come back to a BCMA therapy after the fact and maybe use something else for a year or something or a few months or whatever and then come back. But I think that's the question for patients. Like, if you have patients come in, what, now that there's this off-the-shelf option and there's the CAR-T option and there's the antibody-drug conjugate option, what do you tell your patients about what do you pick and when? I know it's a very complicated question.
It is. No, and this is where every patient's situation is different. And, you know, this is why we have conversations with our patients and think about the particular circumstances as we sort these things out. And, you know, I would say some very rough guideposts. And so, you know, in terms of CAR T cells versus bispecific antibodies, there's still really limited availability of CAR T cells, both in terms of what centers are equipped to administer them and how close patients live to those centers, and also even at centers that are equipped for CAR T cells like ours, how many slots we have available for patients from the manufacturing, to manufacture. And then in addition to that, there's the time it takes to manufacture the cells. And so there are some patients who really need something urgently for their myeloma. And waiting around for a CAR T cell slot and then getting that slot and then waiting around for the CAR T cell to be manufactured is just not going to get that patient effective therapy fast enough. And so that's the patient that, to me, it makes real that the bispecific antibodies make a lot of sense because they're very effective and they can be started right away. On the other hand, patients, even some patients with advanced multiple myeloma, meaning that they've had a lot of prior therapy, sometimes that myeloma is still under quite good control, and the patients are not actively sick with the multiple myeloma. Maybe they're on a regimen, a combination regimen, and the disease is just starting to progress. The M spike is reappearing and increasing gradually, but they're not actively sick with the multiple myeloma. That might be a good patient to wait around for a CAR T cell slot. And the advantage of the CAR T cells are that it's a one-time therapy that you get it and you don't have to be on therapy, hopefully, if it works, for a long time after that. And there's some real advantage to that. We also don't necessarily have to think about it as either or. You know, my goal with my multiple myeloma patients is to give them a shot at every effect of multiple myeloma therapy. And so it's not necessarily bispecifics or CAR T cells. It might be bispecifics and then CAR T cells later, or CAR T cells now and bispecifics later. And the way that we've made progress for multiple myeloma patients over the last, couple decades is by just making more and more treatment options available, allowing patients an opportunity to try more and more therapies, and that has extended survival for longer and longer periods of time. And to the extent that we know about sequencing, I think it's probably less important than just trying everything at some point. And the sequencing, it really comes down to strategizing a bit about patients' particular situation. When do they need responses more urgently? When can they wait? What's the safest thing at this point versus, and you can just imagine there's so many different situations that can come up when you have all the different variables in the air. And patient preference matters a lot too. And actually, it matters a ton. You know, some patients really want that one-time therapy so that they can maybe be off therapy for a long time. Other patients really want something right now, and the complexity of CAR T cells is kind of daunting to them or just undesirable for some reason. And just it's amazing to be able to have these options to pick from, and I think patient preference should play a big role in some of these decisions.
Well, I know, and kudos to these companies who are developing these products that we can have the option. I mean, how amazing is that? I just think what's happening in myeloma is just so incredible. So I'm really grateful that we even have these. This is not a problem, but it's a good problem to have, to have multiple things to choose from.
No, I agree. It's been amazing just in, I've been practicing myself since 2014, and it's just amazing. I sometimes give a talk to our fellows about multiple myeloma therapy, and I put up on a screen, all the medications that are now FDA approved for multiple myeloma, and it's amazing how the majority of them were not even approved when I started practicing, a little under 10 years ago. And, my mentor, Ed Statmauer, who's the leader of our program here, I remember working with him as a fellow and, in a research project reading over some of his clinic notes from when he was treating patients back in the early 2000s, and it's just staggering the different options we have. There was a lot of high-dose dexamethasone and melphalan pills and, going on in those days, and yeah. It's just amazing how much progress has been made, and I really do You have to be careful about this. Like I said, all this really has to be confirmed in those comparative studies, but we do get the sense that with this new suite of therapies coming online, these CAR T-cells and bispecific antibodies, there's real potential to add years to the expected survival of multiple myeloma patients. And I'm hoping someday, you know, we can get to where we're talking about a cure for some patients. You know, I would say we were maybe surprised, we were hoping with CAR T-cells that we would see a large portion of patients cured as we do with some leukemias and lymphoma. That hasn't turned out to be the case. But maybe there is some portion of patients that are cured, or maybe we can figure out the right combination of these potent therapies plus some of the older therapies that we can get reliably to cures for patients.
Yeah, we're all hoping for that. So thank you for all of your work. It's amazing. Okay, I have two more questions for you, and then I'm going to open it up for caller questions. So if you have a question for Dr. Garofalo, you can call 347-637-2631 and press 1 on your keypad. But my question is, as the immune system, like you talked about the innate immune system versus the adaptive immune system at the beginning of the show, when you look at these immunotherapies, are there other markers that you are watching? Like, do we need to start watching for CD4 counts or I don't even know what else they are, but to kind of determine this, like myeloma-specific immunity or how the immune system is responding or not responding, do you have other markers that you look at on a regular basis that we should all start looking at?
You know, nothing that's really ready to start being used clinically. You know, we and many other groups in the myeloma research community are trying to examine our patients who have received some of these novel therapies and look at who does well and who doesn't do as well and try to understand what in the immune system makes the difference between a responder and a not responder or a long-term responder and a short-term responder. And, you know, increasingly there are some really fancy tools available to us on the research side. You know, the ability to take a bone marrow sample and look at the entire gene expression program of every individual cell in that bone marrow, myeloma cells, T cells, B cells, dendritic cells, all the different cell types that make up the bone marrow. We can look at each one individually and see how their gene expression program differs between patients in different groups of response. And I think that will generate a lot of new ideas about how to improve these therapies going forward. But I don't think any of those results are kind of validated yet or ready to be used in monitoring individual patients right now. It's still kind of in the idea generation phase, but I think we will get to the point where we can, you know, perhaps have some features that we look for, and we say, okay, CAR T cells are better for this person, bispecifics are better for this person, antibody drug conjugates are better for this person, based on, you know, various aspects of their immune profile.
Yeah, or when's the best time? Like, when is my immune system the strongest to be able to have these therapies be the most effective? I think patients would love to know that. I'm sure you would too.
For sure, for sure.
Okay.
And what therapy can we avoid? What therapy should we avoid that can beat up the immune system before we, you know, use some of the immunotherapy? That's an area of really active study.
Right, absolutely. Okay, well, I'm going to jump to caller questions. So we'll start with caller that ends in 4978. Go ahead with your question.
Hello, am I on?
You're on.
Hello, yes? Okay, yeah, a little bit more on the antigens, these targets for the drug. I'm pretty puzzled. Am I correct in assuming that if you find an antigen that is present only on all the cancer cells and on no normal cell, you would have, in a sense, the perfect drug? And I'm confused by, you seem to say that, like, say, BCMA comes and goes in the cancer strain. And how much of this BCMA is on the normal cells? Because, I mean, it seems to me if you only have like 2% of cancer in your plasma, you can't have much more than 2% of the BCMA on the good plasma cells. Otherwise, you'll be getting a lot of side effects. What determines when the BCMA appears and doesn't appear on both normal and cancer cells. And if I could ask just a simple question, a second question, among the side effects, is there known taste disturbances among the side effects? All right, thank you.
Great question.
Sure.
Thanks.
Yeah, great question. So I'll start with the second one, which is a little simpler. So to my knowledge, teclistamab does not cause any disturbances in taste. That is an issue that is that has been seen with a drug called talquetamab, which is another bispecific antibody that targets not BCMA, but a protein called GPRC5D. But we haven't seen that with teclistamab, to my knowledge. So the question of, you were right that a perfect immunotherapy target would be present only on the cancer cells and no other cells in the body. And I'm not aware of any perfect immunotherapy target. I think all of them have some risk of expression on certain normal cells. And in the case of BCMA, the main normal cell that we worry about is the normal plasma cells. And so remember, myeloma is a cancer of plasma cells, but there are also normal plasma cells that are not cancerous in the immune system. Those plasma cells will express BCMA and will be targeted by BCMA-targeted therapies like teclistamab. Now, what I was referring to in terms of expression of BCMA on multiple myeloma cells, yes, that can vary between patients in terms of how much BCMA is on each myeloma cell, what percentage of the myeloma cells express BCMA, and we've seen that that can even change a little bit, you know, in response to therapy. So patients who receive CAR T cells targeting BCMA, the residual myeloma cells that aren't killed by the CAR T cells, those cells will have less BCMA on them. But then as those cells grow, the BCMA levels may go back up on them. And so there's a dynamic aspect to BCMA expression on multiple myeloma cells that may affect how well certain immunotherapies work. There are also some tricks that have been developed to try and increase the amount of BCMA on myeloma cells. So there's a type of drug called a gamma secretase inhibitor, which is an oral medication. And that seems to dramatically increase the amount of BCMA on multiple myeloma cells. And there are clinical trials going on combining gamma secretase inhibitors with different immunotherapies that target BCMA. So I hope that answers your question, although I admit it is a little confusing, and we're still figuring out what makes BCMA go up and down, what makes it go permanently go away versus just transiently go away on multiple myeloma cells, and how that should affect the likelihood of patients responding to different therapies.
Okay, great question and great answer. Thank you so much. Okay, caller, that ends in 1871. Go ahead with your question.
Hey, doctor, I appreciate your time. A couple of related questions here. The first is, are there any clinical trials in the works that are looking at teclistamab being moved up more to a maintenance setting in the U.S.? And the related question is whether you're expecting maybe the side effects to be impacting patients who are getting treatment with teclistamab earlier in the disease course, if they're going to be different than those who are getting it later in the disease course.
Sure. And just to clarify your question about the maintenance setting, do you mean using teclistamab as like a post-transplant maintenance, or do you mean kind of just once you get started on teclistamab, kind of adjusting to a lower intensity maintenance schedule?
Post-transplant.
Got it. Yeah, so both are good questions. So I have heard about some trials in the work testing teclistamab in I think it's already open in Europe. I believe there is a study being run in the European Myeloma Network that is testing teclistamab as a post-transplant maintenance therapy, either alone, I think, or in combination with lenalidomide. Don't quote me on this because I'm just remembering this. I don't have it in front of me. But I believe that is being tested in a trial in Europe in a group of European centers called the European Myeloma Network. And I suspect there will be other studies like that popping up, just as there are now studies testing daratumumab as a post-transplant maintenance. And forgive me, I'm having trouble remembering the other question you asked. I'm sorry.
The profile of side effects, whether it's different.
Sure.
Anticipating any differences?
So I think where you could have issues using it in earlier lines of myeloma therapy is that patients may just be on it for a much longer period of time. And so even using teclistamab and drugs like it in the relapse setting, as was done in these clinical trials, we've had some patients who have been on the drug for years. But you can imagine, but also some patients who progressed earlier, and if, you know, as I mentioned, kind of at 12 months after starting treatment, the patients who are responding, about 70% are still on therapy, but 30% have progressed. And I think that immune suppression is going to be cumulative. You know, the longer you're on an immunosuppressive medication, the more time you have to develop severe infections. And so I can imagine that in trials that are ongoing testing teclistamab earlier on, it's possible, it's such a potent therapy. You know, even with standard myeloma therapy, you know, first or second line therapy can go on for years. And then if you throw in an even more potent therapy, that first or second line of therapy could last for many, many years. And that's a long time to be immunosuppressed. And so I think we could see just numerically more infections accumulate in those patients and if they're on it continuously. And at some point, you know, could you imagine that starts to outweigh the benefit of teclistamab used early on, because some of the other myeloma medications are also very effective early on? That's what these big clinical trials are designed to figure out, and it's going to take some time to see how that sorts out. Like I said, there are some preventative measures we can take for infections, but I think that would be one side effect that I'd worry a little bit more about using teclistamab early on. You know, I'll add that I think it will be interesting over time to test interruptions of therapy with this class of medications. And so perhaps that's the right balance for patients who are getting teclistamab early on, is that they might not stay on it forever and ever the way we do with our typical maintenance therapies. But again, that's a question that really has to be sorted out with clinical trials to figure out if that's a better strategy or a safer strategy than continuous dosing.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for your question. And Dr. Garfall, do you have a minute for a couple more questions?
I do.
To run? I know we're over time. Okay.
No, I'm okay.
Okay. Caller 8430, go ahead with your question.
Cool. Yes. my question is whether there was a higher incidence of neuropathy with the drug. And also, I was under the impression that just like with a CAR T cell procedure, that you had to get some heavy drugs up front before you could start. Do you have to get some drugs that suppress things or whatever, like you do with the bone marrow transplant and the other things, before you can start the teclistamab?
Yeah, so those are good questions. So first, to my knowledge, peripheral neuropathy, and when I think of neuropathy, I think of the kind of numbness and tingling and pain in the hands and feet that can happen with, for example, Velcade therapy. To my knowledge, that was not a side effect that was observed, at least not in many patients with teclistamab. There were other neurologic issues, like I mentioned, the occasional patient who had that ICANS, brain dysfunction that can happen with those initial couple doses, and then that one instance of Guillain-Barré syndrome. But the kind of conventional neuropathy, I don't think was seen, at least not in many patients. So the question about, you know, what we might call conditioning chemotherapy or lymphodepleting chemotherapy, no, that's not required for teclistamab, and that's actually another important difference with CAR T cells. So with CAR T cells, in order to get the CAR T cells to kind of grow inside the body and activate inside the body, before you give CAR T cells, you need to give a little bit of kind of medium intensity chemotherapy, usually with two chemotherapies called Cytoxan and Fludarabine. And that kind of kills off some of the normal T cells in the body, so the body starts producing chemicals called cytokines that help T cells grow. And then once those cytokines are being produced after the chemotherapy, you can insert the CAR T cells in, and then those CAR T cells will grow in the body. That doesn't seem to be required for the effect of bispecific antibodies. So patients didn't require any pretreatment with chemotherapy or anything. They did get some dexamethasone just before the first couple doses of the medication, but no other significant pretreatment.
Thank you.
Okay, great. Yeah, good questions. Okay, last question at 4978. Go ahead with your question.
Yes, two sub-questions. Do all normal plasma cells have BCMA? And secondly, is the reason why the drug increases the chances of infections because it kills the normal cells that produce the immunoglobulins and other things that are that our immune system needs? Thank you.
Sure. So I would say that the vast majority of plasma cells express BCMA. I can't say for sure that there's not some subset of plasma cells that maybe don't, but I would think of BCMA as being a kind of cardinal feature of plasma cells. And so BCMA-targeted therapies would be expected to kill the majority of plasma cells, at least in the bone marrow. In terms of what causes the increased risk of infection, I don't think we 100% know for sure, but our strong sense is that the depletion of the normal plasma cells that make antibodies is a big part of it. And so the loss of antibody production is a big part of it. But it's probably not the whole story, because we can give antibody replacement therapy through intravenous immune globulin, but patients still had some difficulty with infection. So there may be some other immunosuppressive properties of the drug through different mechanisms that we don't totally appreciate yet.
Okay, great. Okay, my last question would be, do you need a caregiver to get this therapy?
Oh, that's a good question. So I would say it's not like CAR T cells where, you're told that you have to stay close to the CAR T cell center for 28 days and can't drive and things like that. I want to be careful what I say because I'm not 100% sure that there's not some language in the prescribing information that speaks to this, but I would say for what I am comfortable saying is that patients who are on this therapy for a long time, they have quite normal quality of life. They don't have a lot or maybe even any cumulative toxicity. There is the risk of infection, more of a risk, but in the absence of infection, patients don't feel a lot of side effects from ongoing therapy even for a very long time, and they certainly don't need any extra caregivers in the kind of the stable phase of therapy. I think it makes a lot of sense anytime somebody is starting a new myeloma therapy to have a little bit of support. As I mentioned, in the first few weeks of therapy, there can be some low blood counts, the requirement for transfusions. I've also just seen patients get a little bit tired during that time. The way I've made sense of that is that thinking the immune system is very active in the body fighting myeloma, and that you can imagine creating some fatigue in those first few weeks. And so it might not be a bad idea to have some extra support and kind of getting to and from the hospital and those initial doses. But whether there's an absolute requirement for it in the REMS program or the prescribing information, I have to double check. I'm sorry, I don't have that at hand.
No, that's okay. You would think it would be a lot less compared to CAR T, so it sounds
yes.
like it, because you're not getting all the preconditioning, you're not getting,
yep.
you're watching for lower level symptoms typically. Okay, Dr. Garfield, you have been amazing, and thank you so much for doing this with us and for staying over time and answering all our questions. We really appreciate your work in helping move this therapy forward through the process and getting it out into the myeloma clinic. And we're just appreciative for everything you're doing in the CAR T space and the bispecific space, and just it's truly terrific.
Well, thank you so much. It was a real honor and pleasure to be here, and thank you thanks to you and HealthTree for all the wonderful support and information you provide to our patients.
Oh, well, thank you so much. And thank you for our listeners for listening to HealthTree Podcast for Multiple Myeloma. And we invite you to join us next time to learn more about what's happening in myeloma research and what it means for you.